This podcast of The Exchange is sponsored by Dartmouth Hitchcock, creating a new model for healthcare where leading health systems collaborate to improve care for all of us. A sustainable system improving the health of our communities for years to come. Information at imagine.d-h.org.
And the Dagoba Group, a global diversity and inclusion consulting practice with specialties in unconscious bias, leadership dynamics, and client engagement. Authors of the book, The Inclusion Dividend. More at thedagobagroup.com.
And Northeast Credit Union, helping their members save money through free checking accounts and refinancing of auto, home, and personal loans. Northeast Credit Union, encouraging you to discover the difference at necu.org. Federally insured by NCUA, Equal Housing Opportunity.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. Our guest today is the author of the international bestseller, Reading Lolita in Tehran. Since it was published a decade ago, the book has been translated into more than 30 languages, spent nearly 120 weeks on the New York Times bestseller list, and has won numerous awards. Reading Lolita is about Nafisi's time as a literature professor in Tehran as a revolution was changing Iranian culture and society, including crackdowns on women and intellectuals. For a time, Professor Nafisi attempted to continue her classes for young women in her home. Ultimately, that became too difficult, and she came to the United States. Today, Nafisi lectures and writes at Johns Hopkins University on topics such as intellectual freedom, the politics of literature and culture, and the human rights of Iranian women and girls. Tonight, Azar Nafisi will be the keynote speaker at the New Hampshire Humanities Council dinner, and she joins us in studio this morning. You can join us, too, with your questions and comments. The exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. And Professor Nafisi, it's really nice to meet you. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having me. It's an absolute pleasure to be here.
And welcome to New Hampshire, by the way.
Thank you. Looks gorgeous, the leaves.
Well, good timing. Well, I did want to go through your personal narrative just for a little bit, please, Professor Nafisi, because probably half the audience listening has read Reading Lolita in Tehran and half has not. So just remind us, if you could, please, what was Iran like before the revolution in the late 1970s? Politically, culturally, what was it like?
The way Iran was like, and in fact, the way Iran is like right now, that other Iran is something that I believe Americans know very little about if they just listen to the usual, talks about Iran. The culture goes back to 3,000 years ago, half of which was after the Arab invasion in seventh century, half of it. The time it was Muslim, and before that it was Zoroastrian, and you still have the Zoroastrian influence in Iran. For example, we celebrate New Year at the beginning of the Spring Festival, 21st of March. Iran was, at the beginning of last century, my great-grandmother and grandmother's time, started to change. It was the first country in Asia to have a constitutional revolution, which was bringing in modernism to the country, creating a constitutional monarchy, and the revolution was essentially against the absolutist monarchy and the absolutist religion. I can go on. You should stop me.
Well, and it's fascinating. We could go back hundreds or thousands of years. But so before 1979, there was the Shah.
There was the Shah, and you see, the whole point about Iran is that people have this idea that, for example, the rights of women specifically was given to them by a Shah, that an Ayatollah took it away. And it's not like that. The history of women's struggle goes to 19th century. We had before the revolution two ministers, female ministers, one for higher education and another one, the second of her job in the whole world after the French. We had a minister for women's affairs. My own mother went to the Iranian parliament. She was one of the first six women to be admitted to the Iranian parliament in 1963, which, by the way, is 11 years before Swiss women got their right to vote.
Take that,
Switzerland.
So you
see, that picture is completely different from what the Islamic Republic calls our culture.
So in that time under the Shah, I mean, is it correct to say, Professor Nafisi, that women had more influence in society, a bigger role in society? But the Shah also had a, can I call it a totalitarian regime? I mean, it wasn't a democracy.
Well, yeah, that is sort of the tension between having a society that culturally and socially is very vibrant and sophisticated and modern, but at the same time there is a political system that is still repressive. And so people were comparing Iran not to less progressive countries, but to Western democracies. And they felt that what they needed was, not fulfilled. The whole point was that once you don't like what you have to look forward, not backward. You should be careful also to what will come next. You can't just be against the system. You have to be for something. And I think that is where we made a mistake in terms of not paying attention to Ayatollah Khomeini's totalitarian tendencies.
You lived abroad. You lived in Iran. You studied at the University of Oklahoma, studied some in Switzerland. Were you in Iran at the time when these rumblings of revolution were happening, Professor?
I was a fiery student activist in America in late 70s. And I criticize it in both my memoirs, things I've been silent about, and in reading Lolita. I think that you see traces of it even in my recent book, Republic of Imagination, because I realized that in order to defeat something that is oppressive, you yourself have to be more democratic. You cannot use the tactics that they themselves are divisive and ideological, which is what we in the student movement did. At the beginning, I had no idea what was really happening. And I went back right after the triumph of revolution, the fall of 1979, the first attack was on women. Women, culture, and minorities are always the first targets. And from then on, I realized that this is going to be trouble for the country and for me as well.
Well, it's really interesting. So you came back in 1979 thinking that this could be a good deal?
Already when I was on my way to Iran, certain really bad signs were happening. First of all, Ayatollah Khomeini gave a fatwa for women having to wear the veil, and hundreds of thousands of women came into the streets shouting, freedom is neither Western nor Eastern, freedom is global, and the vigilantes were throwing acid into their faces. Anyway,
at
that time,
that, yeah.
The Ayatollah had to take his words back. I have the pictures of it from Newsweek or Time in my memoirs, of these amazing women coming into the streets. And by the time I got to Iran, they had already closed down some of the most progressive journals and magazines, and were sort of dividing people by, seculars and Orthodox, So there were really signs that worried me a great deal. But then when I lived there, it was a different story.
So, Professor Nafisi, here you are coming back. You've been studying in Oklahoma. You come back. All this is going on. It isn't working out the way that you would hope. What did you think? Did you think I shouldn't have come back? I should have stayed?
No, I think that, adversity teaches you a great deal. And I think that I have to thank the Islamic Republic for a lot of things, including the fact that it made me realize how important individual rights and human rights are to the well-being of individuals within a society. Because before that, I was very political and ideological. And when I went back to Iran, my fight was no more just ideological or political. It was existential. The question that was important to me then, and it is important to me now, was how can I, as a woman, as a teacher, as a writer, as a human being who believes in human rights, live a life that is with dignity. The dignity of individuals became essential to the way of living. And that is what people in Iran are fighting against, as people in China do or people in North Korea do. You know, it is individual dignity and respect.
Including intellectual dignity, which is so important to you.
And as you know, the first thing they attack in any totalitarian society is imagination and ideas. As the saying goes, they first burn books, then they kill people. It always goes together. And that is something that I address in my recent book, Republic of Imagination, that we in this country right now don't realize the importance of ideas and imagination to the well-being of a democratic society.
Well,
that
we
is
are
what
definitely going to get to that. Not so much that we're burning books, but maybe people just aren't reading them anymore.
Indifference is just as bad.
We'll definitely get to that. I want to remind our listeners that they can join us to the exchange number 1-800-892-6477. Our guest today, Azar Nafisi, author of the best-selling Reading Lolita in Tehran and other books, which we will also talk about. She's a visiting professor and executive director of cultural conversations at Johns Hopkins University. She's in New Hampshire as the guest speaker for the Humanities Council annual dinner tonight. And you can join us now at 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Again, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. You can find us on Facebook or Twitter. You know, we had a Muslim human rights activist in studio just about 2 weeks ago, and she said something exactly what you said, Professor Nafisi. She said, repressive regimes go after the women first. Why is that?
Well, you know, the basic philosophy, if you can call it that, of a totalitarian mindset is to impose your own voice upon all the multivocality of other voices. So the first thing they target is difference, because that is how you control, to confiscate other people's voices, other people's presence. And women are the canaries in the coal mine. You know, they are the first to be targeted. And right beside them is minorities. Again, difference, something that you might not be able to control. And then right behind that is culture. At the first thing alongside of women that were targeted was universities, and they weren't targeting engineering or science. They were targeting humanities.
So double strike against you. You're a female literature professor.
I had it all. I feel so proud almost. Because, you know, women became semiotic signs in the streets. Just the way they went into the street, just the way they acted, the way they talked, all of this became signs of being for or against the state. And that was the most potent opposition to the regime, women refusing to become the image that they wanted to impose on them.
Give us an example of what you mean, just the way a woman would act going into the street, whether she's going to the grocery store or, you know, whatever.
Well, first of all, you know, when they changed the laws, they changed the laws that hurt the most traditional and the most poverty-ridden women in the country, because they were deprived. Deprived of the right to child custody, they would stone people for adultery and prostitution. But one thing that was the most obvious sign was the veil. And when I talk about the veil, I don't mean that veil is good or bad. What I mean is that veil should belong to a woman's freedom of choice, that no state tell its citizens how to relate or not to relate to God. So that was the issue, because religion is also a victim here. And what happened was that there was a code. now. You had to go to the streets completely covered, you know, the outline of your body not showing. And from the very start, there was opposition to that. So you go and use your weapons of mass destruction, which would be showing a bit of hair, wearing your lipstick. They will take you to jail. They would flog you. They would put you there.
For wearing lipstick?
Oh, yeah. 86 lashes for coming into the streets, you know, not according to. And these young girls will come out and again do it. Now you can jail political groups and destroy them by destroying their leaders. What are you going to do with millions of young people who listen to the kind of music they want to, who come into the streets looking the way they want to? They could not control it. And in fact, after a while, right now, there are so many defections from within the regime because they brought the question of women's choice to the forefront by depriving us of our choice. And it doesn't mean whether you're Orthodox or Reform or whatever kind of a person you are, you know that as a woman, your right is being impinged upon. You know.
So this is the big picture, and you come back, Professor Nafisi, and you start teaching American literature in Tehran. A couple questions and then the very interesting story of what happened to that. Why American literature?
Well, first of all, that is what I was trained for. I loved literature, and then that is what I got my degree in literature with a minor in philosophy and French. So, you know, and I love fiction. So it was both English and American lit that I started teaching. And these are the paradoxes. The society was so sophisticated that they could not force, first of all, they couldn't force women to go back to homes. Second of all, they couldn't change the whole system of education, so people were still teaching. They were forcing the professors to censor the books.
Really?
You had to excise the word wine from Hemingway's stories.
That would be hard.
and so you had to find, I never taught a book that I censored, but there were weird ways of dealing with that, which made you very creative, in fact.
Well, what did you do?
Well, for example, I remember I wanted to teach this French book by Diderot, Jacques le Fataliste, that has a lot of things that they would call obscene in it. But it is an amazing book about the relationship between fiction and reality. So what I did was I gave them Xeroxes because we didn't have. I gave them Xeroxes, and the next time I came to class, I told them this book has a lot of obscene things in it, so we can't teach it at the university, and bring it back next time, making sure that every single student will jump on the book and read it over once you tell them that. So they all read it. You know, and I discussed the book, you know, in class. But if they had, you know, asked me, I say that I was not sure about, you know, those scenes, and I took it off. But it was very stressful having to deal with these issues, having to be at the dean's office every day for some sort of you know, mischief you have performed, you know.
So eventually, Professor Nafisi, it got too difficult. Just got too difficult to be there.
Yeah, it got too difficult in two stages. One was when at first I was teaching at the University of Tehran, and they started changing the curriculum, having a cultural revolution, and also telling that you need to wear the veil. Now, for me, wearing the veil to my classes was very difficult because my students, including my Orthodox Muslim students, had seen me without the veil a week ago. And now they think this woman, for just a pittance that she gets every month, is going to come and do it. So I refused, and that was how I got expelled the first time. I went back 8 years ago when things had become, you know, more settled, and I was in the dean's office really every day. And at some point it became too much, so I decided I'll resign. And I resigned. They didn't accept my resignation for 2 years because they have to expel you. You can't just resign. And that was when I started choosing seven of my best female students and teaching them at home.
And that's where we'll leave off before the break. We'll pick up after a short break what happened inside Professor Nafisi's home, how she ultimately did come to this country, and lessons learned. Let's hear from you, too. The exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. More in a moment. This is The Exchange on NHPR. I'm Laura Kanoy. Our guest today is Azar Nafisi, author of the best-selling Reading Lolita in Tehran. She's a visiting professor and executive director of cultural conversations at Johns Hopkins University, and she's in the Granite State as the guest speaker for the New Hampshire Humanities Council annual dinner tonight. We invite you to join us at 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Post a comment on our Facebook page if you'd like. Find us on Twitter. Again, call in 1-800-892-6477. So, Professor Nafisi, we were just getting to really the heart of the book, which is it gets too difficult for you to teach literature. You pull seven of your best female students and you teach them in your house, including Lolita. I mean, talk about, you know, yeah, a book that's kind of edgy no matter what culture you're in, never mind in Tehran.
No, that is exactly true, because, you know, I wanted to have this experience of how it feels to just be free of all constraints. And talk and act the way you are, not the image that they have created of you. And that was one of the most amazing experiences of my life. Because, you know, these girls would come to my home, and at that time they had to wear all in black, you know. And they would take off their veils, and they would burst in color. Even the one who wore the veil even before the revolution looked different, you know. And at the beginning, we were all very cautious. That is how you act. You act with suspicion.
Well, and you don't know if somebody else is going to rat on you.
And these girls came from all sorts of backgrounds, from Azin, who was just an amazingly free spirit, you know, with her long hair and miniskirts, to Mahshid, who was very shy and you know, Orthodox Muslim girl. And they all opened up as time went by. The books opened them up to the world, but at the same time to themselves. And me too. I mean, I went through the same experience. It wasn't just that I was immune from the transformation.
Absolutely. Well, I'm interested especially in the most Orthodox Muslim student, that she thought it was important still for her to come, and that her parents said it was okay.
Yeah. That is, of course, parents didn't know what people were reading, but even a transgression like that for the family was difficult.
Sure.
But you know, the point was that literature opens you to questioning, and questioning not just the world but yourself. So she would read these books. I remember she had she protested Muriel Spark's Loitering with Intent because the protagonist was committing adultery, you know. But the point was that as time went by and we had these discussions, sometimes they became very hot.
I can imagine.
But they started questioning themselves. Like for Mahshid, the question was, the veil before the revolution was a symbol of her faith. But now it has become not a symbol of faith, but a symbol of the state. And what does that mean for her?
And what does that mean for her and for her faith?
For her faith. And so that kind of questioning was healthy for all of us who were not allowed to question, you know, in the public realm.
The number here in the exchange for you to join us again as we talk with Azar Nafisi, 1-800-892-6477. And Professor Nafisi, let's go to our listeners. And Susan's calling from Walpole. Hi, Susan. Go ahead. You're in the exchange. Welcome.
Oh, thank you. It's a fascinating interview. And I'm wondering, how did the regime deal with the Persian classics, such as the Rubaiyat of Omar Khayyam?
Great question, Susan. And it gets to what you said earlier, Professor Nafisi, that Iranian literature traditions go back thousands of years.
Yeah, and you know, my father always told me that this is an ancient country, and it has been invaded and destroyed so many times, and now it is invaded by the domestic enemies almost. And he said that what gives us identity as Iranians is this poetry. That is what gives us continuity and identity and pride. And the regime at the beginning, especially, they had to conform, finally. You know, we have statues of our poets in our squares and in our streets. We have the names of our main streets after the great poets. And one of the things they tried to do was to bring down the statue of one of our greatest poets, the epic poet Ferdowsi, who had written about Iran in 11th century. He had written about Iran before the Arab invasion and the whole Persian mythology. And you should see the women in those stories. They not only made choices whom to marry, they made choices whom to make love to for one night.
You know, Way back then.
Yes, of course. I mean, you know, it was a whole... And so they were trying to censor not just the modern classics, many of which were completely censored, especially our feminist poets and you know, modern writers, but also they had problems with those classical works. The amazing thing is how Iranian people did not give in. They couldn't bring down the statue of Ferdowsi. They couldn't change the name of Khayyam's street, who was an agnostic poet talking about wine every other line. You know, and that shows where a country's strength is. Now they have conferences on Ferdowsi. They can't beat the people. They better join the people. And they also realize that Iran's respect in the world comes with these great...
From that culture, classical, from that amazing cultural tradition.
And that, for me, is the best proof of how, what Nabokov used to say, governments come and go, only the trace of genius remains. Culture is the best that a people can offer itself and the world.
That
and
story
remains.
That you told me, yeah, gets to a big theme in everything that you write, Professor Nafisi. You know, people might think, oh, the humanities, and oh, that's so nice, and maybe if you don't have that much to do today, but it's not that important. But that story about the poets and how these Iranians just said, you can't take this away, that shows the huge power of culture.
Yeah, that is what
and literature.
And that is what it tells you about how things were. Because, you see, the first thing totalitarian mindsets do, even in this country, is to take away history, to rewrite history, you know. And the first thing you do is go to the culture and history of that country, because it tells you something different. And that is why when I first came to Washington, I thought, oh, my God, you know, there are no statues of a poet or a writer.
No, all generals.
Of course, no women either. I mean, I think there's, and now we have Frederick Douglass and Martin Luther King. We didn't have it then, you know, so that is a little bit troubling.
Susan, thank you so much for the call. And you can join us again at 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Today in the exchange, it's a wide-ranging conversation with Azar Nafisi, author of the best-selling book, Reading Lolita in Tehran. Whether you're curious about the Iranian Revolution and its impact on Iranian society, or you want to talk about the power of literature and culture and politics, 1-800-892-6477 is the number. Email exchange at nhpr.org. www.dharmaseed.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. So just to finish up your own narrative, Professor Nafisi, you had these seven women. It was an amazing experience. Everyone was opened up by the power of these books. At what point did that even become untenable and you made the decision to come here?
Well, we had that class for 2 years. And meanwhile, I had come up with the first book, which was on Vladimir Nabokov, actually. And I realized two things, that two of the things that were so crucial to my existence, one was writing and one was teaching, was becoming completely impossible. That book went out of print very fast, and they didn't allow it to be republished. And nowadays, my friends can't even find it in black market. So I couldn't write if I wanted to write what I really wanted to write. And it is anathema for me to write anything that can be censored. The second thing was that I felt I can't find students like this if I cut my relationship with the university. And I can't teach at the university because I'm thinking more about what am I going to tell the dean the next day, how he's going to treat me, rather than focus on the books I want to teach.
It's very stressful. You know?
And I felt that if I, it came to my husband and I, after long discussions, after staying there for 18 years, I felt that if I left Iran, I could connect to Iranian people much better than had I stayed at home and did nothing, you know. Unfortunately, that was that. It was very painful, and it was very personal.
You had daughters.
Yes.
Children, husband. How did they feel about this?
Well, my daughter was beginning to get a taste of what it was like to be a woman. At that time, she was about 12. And I remember the last New Year we were in Iran. We were walking down the street doing shopping for New Year. And whenever there were these revolutionary guards searching women, people would tell one another before you. And so
don't go down that street.
This young guy who was selling chewing gum actually told us, lady, they are getting those women. And we were standing from a distance watching these two young people sort of into a big argument with the revolutionary guards, who finally pushed them into this minibus and drove away. And my daughter turned to me and said, Mom, even if Dad wants to stay, I want to leave. And I never forget that. And she said, we didn't even go and ask those girls what their phone number was to tell their families. You see, you feel guilty. Even if you're the victim, you feel guilty. You know, you're complicit in what happens there. And there I thought, I don't want my daughter to hate the country that I love so much. And the second thing was that, like what my mother always told me, I want to go and tell them. Tell the world what is happening, you know. And that did it. That did it. Even if my husband didn't want to come, I would have left, I think.
So the book was a smashing success. Translated into 32 languages, numerous awards, gazillion copies. I read in an interview with you somewhere that you said you would have been happy if it had sold 9,000, which now seems crazy. Yeah. But so in a way, you were right, because you left, you were able to publish this book, and now, you know, so many people have read it all over the world.
Yes, you know, when I was writing this book, my friends were telling me, nobody's going to read this book. It's about Iran, and at that time there was the war with Iraq, and they said nobody's paying attention to Iran, and it's about dead white males, and nobody's reading them. You know, and I said, I don't have any choice. I write what comes to me, you know. And that is how I felt. That is why I thought that it won't sell. And the best thing with books is the way it connects you to people that you should be connected to, you know, not because of where you're born or what you do, but because they have the same passion and curiosity to want to know. And I feel very lucky because of that.
One Iranian commentator said your book on your book. He said, "Good for her. She got her revenge on the Iranian government." Do you feel that way, Professor?
No, not
Stacey?
At all. Actually, writing a book makes you understand and makes you have sympathy, or at least empathy, even for your enemies. While I was, you know, in reality, and that person who said it herself felt like that, on some days you felt so angry that you just wanted these people to go, to be dead, to whatever. But at the same time, when I was writing, I realized how powerless people are who want to eliminate you, and how powerful you are. I mean, I'm not talking about myself. I'm talking about the victims of these societies. If someone like Salman Rushdie, for example, whose only weapon is his pen, is so dangerous that a whole state with all those weapons wants to kill him, that shows how powerful this man's pen is, and how powerless that state feels that you have to eliminate this one individual. You know, so the way I felt when I was writing was that there were so many of my Muslim Orthodox students who were part of the regime, but who were also human, who were reading these books and changing. One set fire to himself while I was teaching Henry James. I mention it in Reading Lolita. He came to school one morning with 2 gallons of petroleum, and he poured the petroleum over his head and set fire himself and started running down the hall saying, "Look what they've done to us." And this guy belonged to the militia. You know, he had power of life and death over us, but he was the one setting fire to himself.
So why did he do that? To protest
because
what they were doing?
A lot of the genuine revolutionaries, after a while, became disenchanted.
I see.
They became disenchanted. And you feel that writing helps you understand, and understanding is the best weapon against dictatorship. I didn't want to destroy the regime. I wanted to change mindsets so that there won't be another dictatorship.
You mentioned Salman Rushdie. I have to ask you this. Have you received any threats?
I have received a lot of slander. I have been called all sorts of things, from being an adulterer to being a spy for the CIA and a native agent, you know. My family has been slandered. But no, I haven't received death threats yet. I shouldn't. You know, and I don't want to turn it into myself into this sort of an icon or a hero. You know, I'm a writer. And one thing that I had been wanting people to realize is that fighting for your dignity is an existential thing and not a political matter, because people constantly call you political. While I'm not here belonging to a political group, I'm not here to change a regime, I'm here to defend what I believe is human dignity.
Your story about you going out with your daughter in the street, seeing the Revolutionary Guard, seeing them take some other young women away, makes me wonder, Professor Nafisi, is it like that now in Iran?
Well, certain things have changed because Iranian people didn't give in. You know, now, when I left Iran, the former prime minister of Iran, Mir Hossein Mousavi, and the former speaker of the house, Mr. Karoubi, they were free people. They were the founders of this revolution. Now, they are the ones who are in jail. So what I'm trying to say is that as time went by, many people from the other side joined this side. And that is the amazing thing about such matters, about a culture, about a people's resistance. It's not all about violence. It is about people refusing not to be themselves. And so changing those who were trying to change them. And that is what makes me hopeful. That is, I am I'm not optimistic, but I'm very hopeful. And I'm very proud of Iran's civil society, especially its amazing women.
We'll talk more in just a moment about that. Contemporary Iran, what's happening there now, and the role of literature in politics and culture. Stay with us. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. This hour, Azar Nafisi, author of the international bestseller Reading Lolita in Tehran, and her newer book called The Republic of Imagination. She's a visiting professor and executive director of cultural conversations at Johns Hopkins University. She's in New Hampshire as the guest speaker for the New Hampshire Humanities Council annual dinner tonight. You can join us with your questions and comments, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. And Professor Nafisi, so let's talk about the most recent book, An Exploration of American Society Through Several Major Works of Literature, again called The Republic of Imagination. What does American literature teach us about America?
Well, I wrote this book, The Republic of Imagination. My editor keeps reminding me that at the end of Reading Lolita in Tehran, I was already getting ready to write this book, because at the end of that book, I ask a question that Bello puts to us in one of his books. He says, those who survived the ordeal of Holocaust, how will they survive the ordeal of freedom? And I felt that freedom, especially in great books of literature, especially in great novels, American novels, comes to us as a responsibility and as an ordeal. And a lot of times we forget that freedom should be fought for every day of our lives. It's not something that is given to you and then you can have it forever and ever. And when I came to America, I realized that the denigration of imagination and ideas comes with denigration of the reality we live in. And there is a direct relationship between things not going well, the crisis that we're having, and the crisis of imagination as well. That was how I started thinking and writing about Republic of Imagination.
What is that denigration that you talk about?
Well, you know, if I want to talk about it in a very concrete terms, I would say that you see it, for example, in our system of education. You see, there are two things that are bothersome about our system of education. One is that in a democracy, every citizen has the right to quality public education and quality public health. And rather than doing that, we're destroying our public schools. We're not giving them enough resources. We're not providing teachers with enough respect and funding so that they do their job well. The second thing is that we're taking out of public schools music, literature, and art, everything that gives them the power to think and to imagine.
Why do you suppose that is?
Well, I think that, and that is where the great American fiction comes. When you read Huck Finn, you see that there are two sides to the American dream. You see, at least as a new citizen, that is how I see it. One is a very materialistic dog-eat-dog world type of a thing, where individualism means selfishness and greed, basically. And the other is what Huck Finn or other great, or Zora Neale Hurston, they represent, which is reminding us that this country was built on a dream, which meant that it was built on imagining something that didn't exist and making it happen. That needs taking risks. That needs failure even, you know. And what I felt was that that is taken away from us. And will we become good citizens if we don't know anything about our history and our culture, and if we only want to make more and more money?
So a culture, a society, a country that was built on imagining something that didn't exist is now taking away expressions of that imagination as it increases its emphasis on, I don't know, business, science, technology, engineering, and math, you know, STEM, that's what everybody is concerned about. You're saying that's trouble.
Yeah, well, you know, first of all, it is almost a crime. I shouldn't use the words like this. When you segregate science, technology, and math from literature, philosophy, and history.
And because, one is denigrated above the other.
Because of the fact that both great science and great literature are based on this essential human trait, which is curiosity, which is the desire to know. And that curiosity is not vain or futile. It is in order to survive. So science comes with understanding the natural world in order to be able to change that world, in order to make it more habitable for us. And math comes about dealing with the abstractions. Math is far more abstract than literature. And literature comes with understanding what it means to be human. You know, why is it that from Greek, Persian, Roman mythology, to Bible, to Quran, to Torah, every single thing has been told through a story? Because we understand ourselves through story, and we connect to others through stories. You take that away, you'll become an automaton. It's a brave new world where you only feed your stomach, you know, without living. You know, it's very essential.
It's interesting that you say Brave New World. I just reread that.
Yeah.
For the first time since high school or college.
It
was very interesting rereading that as an adult. Professor Nafisa, let's go back to our listeners and hear what they have to say. And Steve is calling from Nottingham. Hi, Steve. Thank you so much for calling. Go ahead.
Good morning.
Morning.
I love the idea of learning through stories. But I'm asking you a story now about the current regime. This will sound political, and it is. Because right now, I'm probably more interested in Iran to see if there's going to be a war, which is not very humanitarian. And so, oversimplified, do you trust, I know in the old days you left for good reason, do you trust the current people there, or should we trust them?
Steve, thank you for the question. Yeah, and it's veering into politics, but I do wonder, it's a good question, how you feel about the folks who are in power now?
To empower Iran?
In Iran, yeah.
Well, first of all, I think that before we focus on the world, we need to focus on ourselves. And what frightens me about relationships, not just with Iran, but with the world, is how little our policymakers know about them. Iranians, when they come to negotiate with America, know about America. Mr. Zarif went to University of Colorado. He knows American culture. He knows American nuances. He can be a great negotiator. We know very little about that country. And when you know very little, you don't know when to be firm. You don't know when to negotiate, when to be flexible. And you can't expect to trust others if you don't trust yourself. I always look at what the Iranian system says with doubt. You know, but that doubt should be based on something concrete that I know. And that is what is lacking right now.
Steve, thank you so much for the call. And here's an email from Ben in Hudson. He says, since she's so familiar with Iran, can she briefly discuss the lingering resentment Iranians feel toward America for overthrowing their government? Do the Iranian people draw a distinction between the American people and the U.S. government? So two questions there. Let's take the first one, because we didn't discuss this, Professor Nafisi. The Shah was put in place by the U.S., right? So was there resentment there?
Well, first of all, you know, it is very difficult in one radio conversation to cover
Absolutely.
All of these. Very, very briefly, the Shah was supported by America, and the mistake was rather than negotiating with the very popular Prime Minister Mossadegh, we sort of left room for resentment by that very specific and obvious support. But the whole point here is that the Iranian people do not resent Americans. You remember that that in 9/11, after 9/11 happened, thousands of Iranians, against police warnings, came into the streets of Tehran and other cities holding flowers and lighting candles in support of American people. You know, they do differentiate between Iranian American government's policies and American culture. American culture is one of the most... It is the most dangerous to Iranian or Chinese or Saudi Arabian regimes. What is dangerous about America is not its military might, but its culture of democracy. My students were in love with Marx Brothers, with Humphrey Bogart. They were. That is what my children were brought up on when I wanted to teach them about America. They started with Wizard of Oz. I mentioned in Republic of Imagination, the first book I read about America was when I was 6, and it was The Wizard of Oz, you know. So it is through your culture that you can create conversation, and it is through Iranian culture that you can start communicating with Iranian people.
Thank you for the email, Ben. And let's go next to Wilmot, where Sid Ra is on the line. Hi, Sid Ra. Go ahead. You're in the exchange. Welcome.
Thank you. Can you hear me?
Sure can. Yeah.
First of all, I want to tell you how much I appreciate the work that you've done, the writing that you've done, Professor Nasizi. I'm a professor of Hebrew literature at the Hebrew University in Jerusalem. I'm in
wow.
New Hampshire part of the year. But our struggles are parallel,
mm-hmm.
And I just want to say this idea that poetry makes nothing happen is, you've definitely given the lie to that. I really believe, and at the moment there's shooting going on in Jerusalem as we speak. All of my children and grandchildren are at risk, but the whole project is at risk. And the Temple Mount, as you well know, is the center of the struggle. And if you believe in literature and you read carefully and you read the story of the sacrifice of Isaac or Ishmael in the Quranic version, it's really a comedy.
Yeah.
You know, it's not a tragedy. It's a backing away from tragedy. And if we understand that living with an understanding of the power of poetry as opposed to the power of, you know, exclusive claims to holiness actually can be our salvation. I don't put a lot of store by this, but that's what I'm writing about now. That's what I'm teaching. And I have so much admiration for what you're doing for American, you know, literature in other parts of the world. But there's so many struggles now that the literary and poetic imagination could actually help us to, I think, win.
Sid Ra, thank you so much for calling. Yeah, go ahead.
Thank you so much. I very much appreciate and empathize with what you said. I believe with Shahrazad in 1001 Nights that in order to fight violence, you need to take people to another domain, that you should not speak the same language as your oppressor. And one example, actually, is the fact that Amos Oz, one of your great writers, is a popular blockbuster in Tehran. So, you know, there was this site directly between Israeli and Iranian people where both sides said, we don't hate you. And the same is true of Israeli and Palestinian people. People and their culture want to connect and communicate. It is against this divisive, ideological, power-hungry leadership that we need to fight. And by the way, I love David Grossman and Amos Oz and Yehoshua. And that is how we hope to even fight the violence, the current violence in the world and in your region.
Sidra, thank you again so much. And here's an email from Nancy who says, could you please comment on the access that modern Iranians have to literature, both their own and the world's? In addition to addressing political censoring, I'm also wondering how common it is for world literature to be translated into Farsi, or how well young people are educated in English, French, or other languages that would give them access to world literature. She also says, you know, are books affordable? Are there free public libraries? So just a broad question from Nancy, and thank you, Nancy, about how accessible literature in general is to Iranians today.
Iran is a very sophisticated and cosmopolitan society and culture. When I was a child, all of these great masters of world literature were translated. I mean, by the time I left Iran when I was 13, I had read Victor Hugo, I had read Stendhal, I had read almost all the Russians, Tolstoy, Chekhov, Gogol. I had read Pride and Prejudice and Great Expectations, and I had read Wizard of Oz and Tom Sawyer, and so did my daughter. And so that is the amazing thing about things that are genuine. Things that are genuine endure because people don't let them die. And so despite all the efforts by the Islamic regime to cut Iran from other parts of the world, either in open, the translations, a lot of things are translated and then the regime discovers that they are not, they shouldn't be, or especially now through the internet, despite punishing the bloggers, trying to block the internet. These amazing young people find ways. And when I was in Iran, I knew far more about who won the Pulitzer Prize for Literature or the Oscars than I do now.
Well, and it's harder and harder to block access.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, you talked a minute ago with our caller who teaches at Hebrew University about the cultural connections, even and maybe even especially between cultures that have been in conflict. You have a project now, speaking of the internet, on Twitter, Professor Nafisi, to try and make those connections. Tell us about
well,
that.
Well, I tell you that I was very technologically challenged and I hadn't used Facebook and Twitter until my recent book, Republic of Imagination, was published. And then I realized that I really need these connections. And so alongside of the book, we created this campaign called Book Save. You can go on my website or Facebook or on Penguin's website and Facebook and find out more about it. But it is about dedicated readers, you know, giving us quotes about the books that influence or change their lives. The purpose of this is the first step, is to create a connection between readers from all over the world. I'm getting a lot from Italy, I'm getting some from Iran, I'm getting some. So I hope that your listeners will participate in this and tweet me or tweet Penguin or tweet both of us or tweet the world, you know. Just tweet, people.
We will find a way to put it on our website so that people can access it more easily.
I appreciate it.
Thank you so much for coming in. And good luck tonight at the Humanities
Thank
Council.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
That's Azar Nafisi, author of the best-selling books Reading Lolita in Tehran and The Republic of Imagination.